You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, a special edition. We are looking once again at the Roman emperors, where the crazy continues today. My name is Coy O'Neill. I am an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Jordan Poss, adjunct instructor of history at Greenville Technical College in Greenville, South Carolina. Jordan, how are things back east?
Really good. It's still the summer as we're recording this, so I'm actually visiting this time with my parents back in Georgia, otherwise known as God's Country, and making vacation that much better by talking about the Romans. I never pass up a chance.
So what you're saying is you look at summer and think, I need to go farther south.
Actually, from where I live, I'm almost directly west, but I'm a couple of hundred feet higher in elevation, so it's cooler and less humid. So I think when we left Greenville yesterday, it was just over 100 when we got to Clayton, where I'm from, in northeast Georgia. I think it was in the upper 80s, which was a full change of location.
So instead of, 95% humidity, it was like 90% humidity.
And you'd be surprised how much difference that makes.
That's fair. That's fair. I grew up where it's just never humid, and this, even being on the edge of the South, is just awful for me.
The South is the part of the globe which, when viewed from space, fogs up during the summer.
Yeah, I saw a map on I think it was on Facebook or Twitter or something yesterday, where someone had taken the United States by latitude and laid it over a map of Europe, so the latitude lines matched up, and like the American South is basically centered around like Egypt and Libya.
Yeah.
So, it makes sense.
Yeah, well, in the context of what we're talking about, the professor who I took Rome from, who I refer to all the time because he was masterful and was kind of my first academic foray into this, put it in context by pointing out that, the Romans wore basically wool blankets as a business suit. And he said, in the summer it was hot, but in the winter it could actually be an advantage because you don't really think of this, but Rome, the city itself, is somewhere along a similar line of latitude to Chicago. So even though the climate is Mediterranean, it is far enough north for it to get cold.
You go farther north and get into Germany, and then you're talking sort of Canadian latitudes.
Yeah.
Right. Which again, we don't tend to think of Europe as a cold place because you have the ocean currents and everything that keeps some of it cooler some of it warmer. But it really is.
I mean, Iceland lies just south of the Arctic Circle, but stays, it never gets considerably colder than 30 in the winter. I think it does snow and stuff there, obviously, but it never gets much above, I think, the 60s or 70s in the summer. It's, there's a very, very mild fluctuation there because it's, smack dab in the center of the Atlantic Current.
Right. Yeah, I do regret living in D.C. for almost 8 years and not going to Iceland. I feel like I will never be closer to it than I was then.
Man, I've been aching to go forever.
it is on my list. We went to one of those the scams where they like offer you a free hotel room if you listen to their sales pitch. And the first question is, where do you want to, where's your dream vacation? And of course, a lot of people in the room were like, oh, Hawaii. And the idea is you're supposed to stay a place and they'll be like, oh, well, we have a hotel there. Uh-huh. So I was like, I want to go to Iceland. And the guy, I think, had never been told that before.
Well, enjoy the buffet and feel free to go.
Yeah. That was the end of the sales pitch for us, pretty much.
Well, to bring it back to the Mediterranean with one more piece of trivia, I just remembered that my hometown, and I know this thanks to this wonderfully eccentric old man that I used to know, my hometown in Rabun County, Georgia, is on the exact line of geographical latitude as the Rock of Gibraltar. So to kind of, again, talk about the American South as being, the upper end of the deep South is at the southern coast of Spain. So, I mean, everything else is essentially Africa.
Right. With maybe slightly fewer political problems, but only slightly.
Yeah, slightly.
Well, speaking of political problems, we should get into Rome. So today we left off last time with the five good emperors. The death of Marcus Aurelius, his son becomes emperor. This is Commodus. This is the, as we said last time, the first father-son succession we've had in a century since Titus after Vespasian. And the Romans noticed the pattern. You know, they were aware that you have all of these good emperors, and then all of a sudden an emperor, instead of adopting someone, uses his biological son, and they have a bad emperor. And certainly Commodus was a tyrant. The good news is you can't just undo a century of competent and virtuous government. So for all of his excess and corruption, for all of maybe insanity like Caligula, he really doesn't do as much damage as we might have expected. In fact, in some sense, the big problem with Commodus is that he wants all of the fun of having power, but none of the responsibilities. So he turns the government over to his advisors, spends his time at the stadium, watching gladiatorial fights, sometimes jumping into the ring and mixing it up himself. The movie at least got that part right to some extent. Specifically, he gives authority to the leader of the Praetorian Guard, which we haven't really talked about at all. Jordan, can you, and I didn't put this in the outline, so I'm kind of, this is out of the blue, but can you tell us a little bit about the Praetorian Guard?
Oh, yeah. I'll have to wing it a little bit. The Praetorian Guard is a curious institution. There is an ancient Roman prohibition against bringing an army into the city, as we talked about with the kind of crises beginning with guys like Marius and Sulla. The Praetorian Guard sort of exists in defiance of that convention and that tradition. It's essentially a military unit that is, oh man, I hate to make Nazi comparisons, but the closest thing I can compare it to is the SS in relation to Hitler. The SS was the Schutzstaffel, literally the protection unit, sort of a imperial bodyguard, so to speak. Gradually, like the SS, what starts off as basically sort of a ceremonial unit becomes increasingly powerful, and again, gliding over quite a bit of development here, is actually able to acclaim their own emperors. And we're going to see this repeatedly throughout the period that we're about to talk about. That's my postage stamp size summary of it. Would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, they're the only military force in the city of Rome.
Right.
I mean, you're not supposed to have soldiers in Rome at all, but they make an exception for the Praetorian Guard because, as you say, they're sort of a symbolic legion. I think they're a legion, right? Maybe they're not necessarily at full strength all the time.
I think they start off maybe as a single cohort. I can't recall off the top of my head. I think they start off as a relatively small unit, but again, increase in size and strength.
Right. And at various times they have different jobs. You know, sometimes they're the police force of Rome. Sometimes they're sort of the National Guard for Italy. I mean, it just depends on what century you're talking about.
Yeah.
But they almost always have a political role of some sort. They are sort of the big emperor makers. So Commodus puts the commander of the Praetorian Guard, basically in charge of Rome. This guy gets into a lot of conflict with the Senate. The Senate does not really care for the Praetorian Guard. The Praetorian Guard doesn't care for the Senate. Commodus is basically out of all of this. He's busy variously engaging in gladiatorial combat. He decides to go and play general in Dacia for a while. At some point, for reasons that are somewhat clear, somewhat unclear from the sources, Commodus decides that he is ready to take kind of full command of government. He executes the head of the Praetorian Guard that he had put in charge of government, and starts doing things himself, where he shows that he's sort of, on the one hand, a very spoiled rich kid, and on the other hand, a paranoid lunatic, with some cause maybe to be paranoid. They really did seem to be out to get him. There were lots and lots and lots of people grumbling about him becoming emperor. Again, the Romans recognized this pattern, that adoption equals a good emperor. Natural child equals a bad emperor. So they knew that was going on. Numerous attempts were made on Commodus' life, by family members, by senators, by public officials, by, you know, random strangers in the street. People were just trying to kill this guy sort of left and right. And it never really works. It doesn't really, succeed other than to make him more paranoid.
The most famous.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to note, to kind of call back to the movie Gladiator again, and also to that one I talked about last time, The Fall of the Roman Empire. The most famous of the conspiracies is by his sister Lucilla. In the movie, she outlives him. You know, she's spared. Her son is spared, and you know, they ride off into the sunset or whatever. Lucilla is actually a pretty cold-blooded schemer, it looks like, based on our sources, and we can talk about problems with the sources later. She plots against him and is caught and killed. Not exactly your Hollywood ending.
Right. Right. And again, we just have multiple versions of that, right? For various reasons, all of these schemes fail until we get to the last one. So Commodus takes the reins of power himself. Had he not done that, we certainly wouldn't know as much about him. He might have still gone down in history as a bad emperor, but he probably wouldn't have been considered an awful one. He would not be on our bracket for craziest emperor that we'll get to at the end. So he, having become sort of full commander of Rome, declares that he is a god, that people are supposed to call him Hercules. And as evidence of that, he points to all of the animals and people that he's killed in the arena. When a fire burns down the middle of Rome, he declares himself to be also the new Romulus, and then declares a reconstruction campaign where each of the new buildings would be named after him. And the whole city would take the name Commodiana. So he names Rome after himself. The Senate would be called the Senate of Commodus, and then each month of the year would be named after him. He had to give himself some new names to make that work. He didn't have 12 names when he set out with that. Finally, the Praetorian Guard has had enough of this guy. They try to poison him. He was such a drunkard, it doesn't work. He just gets a little bit sick to his stomach. So they finally pay his wrestling coach to slip into his bedroom and strangle him in his sleep. And that's the end of Commodus.
Also the basis for the movie, curiously.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Maximus Decimus Meridius, by the way, is a nonsense Roman name. It doesn't make any sense. Maximus's name in the original screenplay, from what I understand, was Narcissus, which was the actual name of the guy who strangled him to death.
Yeah, so there's a volume of essays out there, and I think it's just called Gladiator, that the historical advisor for Gladiator, she wrote a couple of the essays, and then she edited the volume.
Interesting.
And the first essay is all about why she had her name taken off the movie as historical advisor.
In case it's not apparent.
Yeah. So apparently the original screenplay was not completely accurate, but was at least more in line with the old Fall of the Roman Empire, so closer to being accurate. So the old version actually is, I mean, it's not 100% accurate, but it's better.
Yeah.
And if you've seen Fall of the Roman Empire, I don't remember if we talked about this last time. I think it is incredibly long and boring.
I would agree. It's visually stunning, but it is hard to sit through.
Yeah, so movies, the more historically accurate they are, the more boring I think they tend to be. And that's kind of the catch-22. If you want an exciting movie, you have to be inaccurate. And if you want a boring, inaccurate movie, you have to be boring.
Maybe sometime we could talk about that. Maybe Chris Gerrits is actually doing a couple of blog posts on this at this time. I don't know how far in the rearview mirror this will be when this podcast drops, but visit his blog. He's got a good series started on what makes a good historical movie, just as an aside that I tend to care a lot about.
I hadn't seen that. I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah. The movies that actually nail interesting and accurate are few and far between, but they are very, very good.
Right.
None of them from Mr. Moderator, though.
No, that's certainly true. The number of movies from this time period that are both accurate and good can probably be counted on one hand, if even that. One hand missing some fingers, you know.
We'll have to talk about King Arthur down the road.
Oh, man. Which one?
the Clive Owen one.
Oh, that was a terrible movie and inaccurate. That was kind of worst of both worlds.
Oh, it was bad on every level.
Yeah, I showed selections of the Oliver Stone Alexander the Great movie in class. And of course, if you only watch clips of it, it's fine. And my students were like, well, this is a great movie. And I'm like, no. It's historically accurate for the most part. So think historically accurate for like 3.5 hours. And that's what you've got.
Yeah.
So I guess moving on from pop fiction, popular culture,
sorry.
With the death of Commodus, we once again have a struggle for power. Before we get to that, Jordan, you want to talk a little bit about how we know what we know from this time period?
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit in the last episode as well, but just as a kind of a refresher, both for myself and for the listeners, this is a period, you know, even before the point that we're talking about with Commodus, but definitely going forward into the third century, and we'll talk about exactly how chaotic the third century is momentarily. Our sources get very poor. We know that there's a lot of people writing and working. A lot of that stuff from this time period doesn't survive, for whatever reason. Probably eventually, you know, when, you know, my guys, the monks, are copying things later, their priorities are going to be the older stuff. Also, people are just really busy at this time period. So we're relying on things like that Historia Augusta that we talked about, where historians to this day debate whether or not it's like a piece of fiction or not. It's very difficult to tell. A lot of what we know about Commodus comes from that and from a couple of other sources. And again, they give kind of a sensational view of things. They're also very confused. The Historia Augusta actually gets people, actually gets things out of order just flagrantly sometimes. This is only going to get worse, just to kind of cast forward a little bit. We're about to go into what's called the Year of the Five Emperors, with five guys claiming the throne at various points. That's going to give way to a briefly lived dynasty, which we'll talk about. And then after this dynasty, the Severans, collapses, we go through a period of crisis lasting somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 years, where in our show notes, we've got 33 plus emperors. Doing a rough count in a book that I've got, I came up with over 40, 43, 45. And, you know, if you follow archaeological news at all, every once in a while, they discover a new emperor from this time period, a guy who lasted just long enough to declare himself for the throne, mint some coins, and get killed. Not even long enough to make a dent in the literary record. Historian that I follow on Twitter made an interesting comparison just the other day. He said, minting a coin in this world is the equivalent of a revolutionary group seizing a radio station and, you know, broadcasting that the revolution has come. So it is just as, you know, caveat auditor, it is sometimes very hard to know what's going on in this time period. And so, at least from my point, I'm going to be dealing in pretty, pretty high level and broad discussion here. And a lot of that has to do with the sources.
Right. And know that when I teach this stuff, I teach it from the sort of political science point of view. So if I say something sort of declaratory, like with, you know, with some force behind it, know that Jordan is rolling his eyes or grinding his teeth.
Oh, not necessarily.
we just don't know. So we mentioned Gibbon before. This is where Gibbon picks up.
Yeah.
Gibbon gets good, once Marcus Aurelius dies and Commodus takes over.
Yeah.
And gets really good once we get to the Year of the Five Emperors. You can write a lot about, you know, people who are wicked and crazy, but you can write a lot more about times when there's chaos.
Right. But again, with the provisos that Gibbon was often relying on things like the Historia Augusta, so even some of the most well-regarded of historians of this period, even they are subject, you know, 1,000 years on to some of the same problems.
Right. Anything else about sources in there, or should we hit the five emperors?
Every time I teach this in Western Civ, I kind of stop to note my frustration and tell the students, you know, if you get confused, that's okay, because they were confused.
Right. It's not you, it's them. So speaking of confusion, on the death of Commodus, the conspirators who kill him push an elderly administrator named Pertinax into the job of emperor. The Senate quickly confirms him, and at least as far as we can tell, he surprises everyone. I think the idea had been this guy would be so old he would just let the Praetorian Guard do whatever they wanted. What they found out instead with it, he was very competent and honest and sort of ready to fix Rome. He had served with distinction under Marcus Aurelius. He seems to have refused to be corrupted under Commodus. So even though he only ruled for 3 months, he does manage to sort of straighten out Rome's finances and bring a lot of order back to the city. But then he makes a mistake. Obviously, assassinating an emperor is not what you want the emperor's bodyguards to be doing. So Pertinax announces a reform of the Praetorian Guard, a restoration of traditional discipline among the soldiers. We'll get back to that in a minute. That's not what they had in mind when they put him in power. So they, in turn, assassinate Pertinax. The section in Gibbon on the death of Pertinax is fantastic. I think it's totally made up. I don't think it's even in the Historia Augusta. I think it's just sort of Gibbon's flair. But he does it really, really well. It's this great scene with the aged Roman senator standing in front of this, you know, barbarian member of the Praetorian Guard, and the barbarian just cuts him down. This time, rather than just naming someone, the Praetorian Guard puts the office of emperor up for auction. The guy who promises them the most money is a man named Didius Julianus. But as you'd expect, being willing to pay more for the office does not make you a good emperor. He was instantly unpopular, not least because in order to pay the guard, he had to devalue Roman currency, which is something that I guess it might happen. I don't know enough about modern economics to know if it's actually possible to intentionally devalue American currency, since everything's done on credit these days. I don't know how that would work.
Well, and we use paper money, which is already devalued. So
right, so you can't just cut it smaller to, you know, right, make it worth less.
But I guess the equivalent is just printing more.
I suppose, yeah, printing more or messing with the interest rates, maybe.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure that the being able to deface the debase the currency assumes that you're using something of value there coin your money out of anyway, which we don't do anymore. So
yeah, so what this meant then was that you would either make the money, you know, money is actual metal, gold or silver, you either make it smaller or you mix a less valuable metal in with it, so lead or tin or something like that. And again, the archaeology here gets interesting because you can sort of trace the economics of Rome by the year it was minted and what the coin is made out of.
Yeah.
Which will become really relevant when we get to this crisis of the third century.
Yeah, some of these are basically carnival tokens.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at some point you have money and parts of the empire being made out of wood, which once you've done that, you know, anyone can make their own money.
And in terms of British history as well, which is what I'm most familiar with for some of this period, before the Romans pull out, from that time we have, I think somebody discovered one just a couple of months ago, silver hoards. People right, burying their good cash and for whatever reason not coming back for it. You see a lot of that from about this time period just based on the coins that turn up in these hoards.
Yeah, and again, this is a problem that is not solved until we get to Constantine, who is important in certainly in Christian history, but even if he hadn't converted to Christianity, he is still the guy who fixes the economy of Rome for the next 1,000 years, or the economy of Europe for the next 1,000 years. So, if nothing else, he is at least a financial genius, which we'll get to in a few episodes. News of this gets out to the provinces, where people hear that the office of emperor has been sold and that everyone hates the guy who bought it. So three generals decide that it's their time. These three guys take the title of emperor, when we combine that with Pertinax and Didius Julianus, that's our five emperors. These are Pescinius Niger and Clodius Albinus. Niger is in Syria and Albinus is in Britain. Both of them have some limited success kind of pursuing their claims. I think that's probably one of those places where we should be a little bit suspicious of the sources, because you have, you know, white and black both claiming to be emperor. And the guy who wins it is the third general, a man named Septimus Severus. Anything you want to say about Severus, Jordan? I know that you want to talk about Caracalla, about his kids.
Yeah, just a little bit. Septimius Severus has kind of a mixed bag reputation. And again, this is not the period in which I know the most about. He does have a triumphal arch that is still in the Forum, which you can see today. You can see two things from that. One is that, at least in terms of propaganda value, there's still some kind of military strength going on that can actually even nominally entitle him to build something like that. It's smack dab in the middle of the Forum too. It's right next to the big right next to the Senate House, just below the stairs ascending to the Temple of Saturn. This is audacious. Second, though, it's an indicator also of, you know, the economy still has some legs, because unlike the Arch of Constantine, which is just over the hill by the Colosseum, Septimius Severus's arch looks to be mostly original work, where Constantine's just 100 years or so later is kind of cannibalized from other monuments. As for the mix of his reputation, he's I think admired for some of his military and government achievements, but he also, and we'll talk about this more probably next time when we talk about the rise of Christianity and this kind of Roman soup. But he does institute a fairly severe persecution of Christians, one that gets talked about quite a bit.
Well, and like you said, he is as far as Rome had great generals at this point, he is probably one of them.
Yeah. Right?
So we're still in the Pax Romana, really through the beginning of the third century crisis. We're still in the Pax Romana because other than a couple of places here and there on the borders, there aren't any big enemies to be fighting. So Severus is the general who is from Africa, but stationed in Germany. He is the one of the three claiming the throne. He's the one who's actually had combat experience. You know, there's not much going on in Britain. There's not much going on the eastern border. The big enemy in the east, Parthia, is at this point sort of in chaos itself. So no one's really doing anything with them. So he makes short work of these two enemies. Again, a good general, but not a good politician. So he knows the military stuff forward and backward, but he really doesn't seem to like politics. So what we start to see under Severus is that the government of the empire slowly begins to be transferred from the civil administration to the military. It's never a complete transfer. The civil administration never disappears. But sort of beginning with him, we can functionally say that there begins to be two administrative apparatuses in Rome. Apparatuses. My Latin isn't good enough to know where that fits. But anyway, there are two governments in Rome. And of course, once Christianity comes into power, now you have church government, so then you have three. So Severus is the one who starts that off. And he does that by reforming the Praetorian Guard. So he comes in from outside of Rome with his own legions. The Praetorian Guard had murdered two emperors and then sold the empire. So he says, hey, you guys are the source of all of this trouble. He wipes out the old Praetorian Guard and then builds a new one that is exclusively loyal to him. One source says this new Praetorian Guard had nearly 50,000 men. This becomes his power base and a sort of longstanding reserve force that can be drawn on when the empire is threatened. That again will become relevant farther down the road in the empire. Once you start having barbarian invasions, this military force of 50,000 men in the middle becomes your backup and it gets dispatched when and where it's needed. This doesn't make him very popular with the Senate. The Senate, under Vespasian, had become the aristocracy of the empire. Now this guy comes along and is using the military basically as an aristocracy. Generals, dukes, I guess we would say dukes and counts sort of become the new aristocracy.
And those Latin terms are going to be the ones that get turned into duke and count in the Middle Ages.
Right. So was it dux and comes? Yeah. Something D-U-X, not D-U-C-K-S. Dux and comes. So they sort of take over. The Senate, again, hates Severus. Severus hates them back. He begins the process of cleaning out the Senate and replacing people who oppose him with his own followers. Unlike previous emperors who had done this, Severus does not fire them or change their class or ask them to resign. He charges them with treason and has them executed. So the Senate as an institution begins to fall apart, so that down the road, when civil war finally breaks out, there's no longer a group of leaders who can restore order. That institution that had sort of kept stability through the year of the four emperors, through the year of the five emperors, it's weakened to the point where it basically does nothing from this point on. It's a dead institution. When the army is the main administrative body of the country, the civil war destroys whatever stability you've got. So with all that said, Severus is still a great general. Over the course of his reign, he sort of fights battles on the frontiers, from Parthia to Germany to the border in Scotland. He dies in York, turns rule of the empire over to his two sons. His advice to them, I think, really sums up the direction the empire is going. He tells them to get along with each other, pay the soldiers well, and treat everyone else like slaves. which isn't the sort of thing we would have heard from Augustus or right. Vespasian or Marcus Aurelius. Right, that's telling us something is happening in Rome that's moving things around. And I think what's going on here is that the mechanism for control of power in Rome had been the army since Julius Caesar. Right? The army is where you get your power, maybe even since Sulla. But the army up until this point had always followed someone. right? The army had always had a general who was sort of leading the charge and then would step into the existing institutions. The army didn't have to make any decisions. The army didn't have to do any political stuff other than fight. Now the army itself is becoming political. It's basically the difference between the army supporting whoever becomes emperor and the army choosing the choosing the emperor, which is problematic because that's not what armies are for. Right? The army is not designed to do something like that, where an institution like the Senate is. You know, the army decides things with swords. Well, you can see why once we have this naked declaration that Severus makes, there's going to be a century of warfare coming very quickly down the pike. The legitimacy that stays somewhat with the civilian institutions is ignored in favor of whoever commands the army. Anything to add on Severus, or should we move on to his kids?
No, I think you've summed it up pretty well.
So Caracalla and Geta, what do we know about these guys?
As you said, Septimius Severus's two sons who he tried, and to Septimius Severus's credit, you can see him trying to divide some of the power that he had solely between the two sons to create co-ruling emperors. That is still a system within living memory, right? Of co-ruling emperors,
right.
Both to share power, balance each other out, and to ease the transition when one or the other of them dies. Unfortunately, he's not a very good, like I imagine a lot of parents are, and you know, there but for the grace of God, right? Not a very good judge of his children's character. Caracalla and Geta do rule together for, what, like a year? I can't remember the exact amount of time.
It's a little bit longer than that, I think. I think it's 7 or 8 years, but they're in different parts of the empire.
Right. I can't recall, but it is not long in the grand scheme of things.
Well, they co-rule with him for a while, so maybe that's throwing my numbers off a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. There's so much overlap. That's one of the things that also makes this period really confusing as well. And, you know, again, we'll get to that momentarily. The primary thing to know about Caracalla and Geta is that eventually Caracalla kills Geta. We've actually got a instance of fratricide, right? Just like Romulus and Remus, 1,000 years before, at least according to legend. This leaves Caracalla solely in power, and probably the big thing we want to talk about in terms of government and politics is even though Caracalla is a tyrant in the connotative sense of the term, rivaling in some respects Commodus, he does issue one decree that is sort of named for his line. Which is the Constitutio Antoniniana. We call him Caracalla just to, kind of keep all of these guys straight. He still went by a name that included things like Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, things like that. So all of these guys are trying to establish some kind of legitimacy for themselves as the rulers of Rome by harking back to the last of these good emperors. The Constitutio Antoniniana grants citizenship to virtually all free men in the Roman Empire. And there's a couple of competing explanations for this. One is that because only full citizens could be subject to an inheritance tax, Caracalla was basically making a power play to be able to expand the tax base. War is probably the most expensive thing that human beings do, and the Romans are practicing a lot of it. The army, despite the shrinking of the population of the empire in general, the army is holding steady and getting bigger and consuming more and more of the empire's energy and resources, and that takes a lot to maintain, so he's looking for more sources of revenue. Very probably this is part of the reason for this. I'll let you say some more on this in a second, but what I want to highlight is, as you pointed out with Septimius Severus and the kind of trend that he indicates, this has serious implications for the military. Prior to Caracalla, one of the major reasons people from within the empire joined the Roman army was in order to earn citizenship. You serve, you spend your, the length of service depended on the time period we're talking about, but usually something like 17 or 20 years. You serve your 17 years. When you get out, you get life in a colony, right? Like, I think we talked about Cologne, Germany last time. You get possibly some land. You settle down. You have your citizenship. You have the rights of marriage, of passing on your possessions to your descendants, voting, running for office, things like that. These are enormous privileges, as had been apparent as far back as the social wars, right? Now there is no reason for you to join the army if that's what you're after. You got it anyway. This is part of a long-term trend of these kind of sweeping military changes. I talked about a few of those with Trajan last time, just kind of in the specialization of the army. But a couple of other things have happened. First, there's this, which grants citizenship and removes that incentive for joining the army. Second, in order to convince more men to join the military, they sort of stop shifting around legions like they used to. There's a couple of pieces of legislation from a couple of different emperors in relation to this. But the general trend is that they kind of, in order to decrease discontent and the likelihood of mutiny, and this is an increasing danger, especially with armies just up and declaring their own emperors and marching on Rome, leaving legions basically permanently stationed in a particular place. This means that the soldiers start putting down roots, they marry local girls or bring their own wives out. That means as well that they are getting very, very attached to the generals who command their legion in their locality. And all of these different factors, the lack of a reason to join, the kind of local orientation of the troops, as well as the intense loyalty that they form to the generals who lead them, is just going to further cause more trouble as we go forward.
Right. And Caracalla, of course, if you no longer have that incentive to join the army, you need people to join the army, but right. If you need people to join the army, you have to give them some kind of incentive.
Right.
We'll see down the road, they begin recruiting outside the empire.
Right.
No one in the empire needs to join to be a citizen. So now you have to start bringing in barbarians, which causes further problems. Not so much during this crisis of the 3rd century. Rome sort of gets off lucky that they're not fully invaded. It would have been a good time to do it, and for whatever reason, the surrounding peoples just don't.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I forgot that aspect of it too.
Well, again, it's a century later that really comes into play. Caracalla also sort of loosens the discipline of the military, and to make it attractive, he does double their pay.
Yeah.
Which is how he stays in power as long as he does, even though he's nuts. But he stays in power for so long because he makes the lives of the soldiers easier by making them have to work, not as hard. They run fewer laps or whatever. And he increases their pay, but to increase the pay, again, he has to devalue the currency.
Right.
So again, we have this currency devaluation going on. Yet another emperor who I think is possibly insane. He decides that he's the reincarnation of Alexander the Great, and that he is destined to conquer the Persian Empire, which is interesting because there is no Persian Empire at this point. There's a Parthian Empire, but they are not the Persians. That doesn't stop him from taking three legions and ordering them to equip themselves like a Macedonian phalanx. A form of combat that's been extinct for half a millennium at this point. There's a story in Cassius Dio that when the city of Alexandria heard about this, they had several plays put on making fun of Caracalla. That's rarely a good idea. He sends the legions in for nearly a week of plunder and destruction. Dio says that more than 20,000 people were killed. So this guy has some serious issues. To nobody's surprise, he gets assassinated. Interestingly, while he is taking a potty break, he gets assassinated.
The Eglon special.
And is sorry, that takes me a second.
Sorry.
That was good.
My favorite story from the Book of Judges.
He gets replaced by Macrinus, who is sort of a point of bright light in a fairly dark place. He was a skilled lawyer, so he was an equestrian. He was not a patrician. He respects the Senate and technically had served in the military. So he has sort of the three essential groups of society are all behind him. It's a little unclear how he actually gets the job in the first place, but he does. Even better, he has a good head for numbers. He has no real desire to go fight silly wars outside the borders of the empire, and he certainly doesn't think he's Alexander the Great. So he goes about trying to sort of solve the problems that Caracalla had caused. So first he revalues the currency. which is fine, but it results in deflation. So as sort of as bad as inflation can be, deflation is worse in the short term, because it makes it harder to repay debts. Even if it's healthy for the state in the long term, it's still very difficult in the short term. He reduces the pay of the army, you know, ominous music in the background at that point. He's too busy to visit the city of Rome itself while he's trying to clean up Caracalla's mess. And he makes a deal with the Parthians. Now, remember, Caracalla was about to invade just because he thought he was Alexander. That quite reasonably involved an apology to them. That doesn't go over well with the army or with the Roman people. Some of Severus' family see an opportunity here. They start talking about getting a real emperor back on the throne. The Severan who looks most like an emperor is put forward as a candidate and declared emperor, and Macrinus is executed, which brings us to I always get this guy's name wrong. Elagabalus? How do you say his name, Jordan?
I think my professor said Elagabalus.
Elagabalus.
It trips off the tongue pretty easily, so that's just how I say it.
Elagabalus. All right. I'm going to claim it's not my fault because it's a Syrian name. It's a name that's not Latin and not Greek. The Greek version is Heliogabalus. His mother swore that he was the legitimate son of Caracalla, which he may or may not have been. But his mother was at least the niece of Septimus Severus. So there was some kind of real family relationship going on there. And it tells you who sort of the real force is in his life. It's the pushy mother, right? So pushy that she starts campaigning for him to be emperor a few months into Macrinus' rule, even though, he was only 14 at the time. And then his grandmother gets in on the act as well, and Macrinus doesn't really have a chance. Like most teenagers, he has no interest in politics at all. What he does have an interest in is getting his way and having lots of sex, so that he declares that all Romans have to worship, I'm gonna butcher the name, Elagabal, the god that he has named after, this local Syrian deity. And to drive home the point, he himself, declares himself a priest of this god, and then marries the chief Vestal Virgin in Rome. Which I'm sure you can tell by the name was not supposed to get married.
Right.
He also brings a meteorite to Rome and commands the Romans to worship it, as a sign of their worship for this god, that he renames the God of the Undefeated Sun. To prove his own devotion to this god, he has himself circumcised in the Senate during a live session, to show his devotion. And my thought is I have no interest in that religion for many reasons, but possibly that one pretty high up on the list. Yeah. At this point, the legions start to realize that they might have made a mistake in putting this guy in charge. Honestly, the religious weirdness might have been tolerated if not for the sexual weirdness that follows. He starts taking mistresses, both male and female. What's the name for a male mistress? Is it just Mister?
the word that jumps to my mind from that would be appropriate to this time period would be like a catamite.
Yeah, that may be the case. There's just not a good sort of mistress of male equivalent.
Yeah, I mean the modern euphemism would be lover, I guess, but I don't.
Right.
That's so vague.
Right. Pool boy, maybe. I mean, I don't know. So he weds and divorces at least five women, has his male lovers move in with his wives. He then starts wearing makeup and describing himself as the wife of Elagabal, and offers a reward to any physician who can change his gender. In the last 5 years or so, scholarship on this guy has picked up a notch. He's increasingly considered the first transgendered person in history. As it becomes sort of more and more clear that he's not emperor material, his grandmother, who's functionally running the nation at this point, starts telling people about her other grandson, this one who's only 13 at the time. And, you know, at first it's sort of normal grandmother stuff, you know, oh, isn't he handsome and smart and full of potential? But very quickly that gets scaled up to things like isn't he worthy of power and emperor material? Finally, the legions get the hint and have Elagabal. You're going to have to say that.
Again, this is just how I've heard it. I'm not sure this is correct, but Elagabalus.
There we go. They have him and his mother murdered, and they put in his place Severus Alexander. Anything to add on this, the wife of the sun here?
Just a couple of quick notes. I had no idea about some of that wife of the sun stuff. I knew he was a devotee of a really weird Oriental religion. And that even as far removed from their stodgy ancestors as they are now, that was a bit much for the Romans. Yeah, that just kind of blows my mind. I was having to process some of that as you were reading, because again, I know the broad outlines of Elagabalus, but not some of the stranger stuff. One thing I would point out with Caracalla and the incident with the city of Alexandria, his kind of quashing of, I mean, what is essentially mockery, right? We could call it political speech right now. Just a side note that I find interesting, and this may come up when we talk about Christianity, that is one of several candidates for the incident in which the Library of Alexandria is destroyed.
Right.
Yeah, there's an incident as far back as Julius Caesar, I believe, in which there's a riot in the city, and some chronicler notes that a library was destroyed. There's a persistent myth that sort of anti-intellectual Christians in the city raided and destroyed the Library of Alexandria. That has no firm support, and there's not really – we cannot pinpoint when the library was destroyed, much less that it was the result of that kind of anti-intellectual attitude. If anything, what we do know about Christian activity in Alexandria should point at the opposite, but that's just – Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
It really depends on who's telling that story.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, it's if you're a Christian telling the story, it was the Muslims or it was the pagans. And if you're a Muslim, yeah, it was the pagans or the Christians. And it just depends.
Yeah. And I mean, it could feasibly have been destroyed or severely damaged as far back as Julius Caesar. We just don't know.
Right. Yeah. Anything else about Crazy Pants here?
I think you covered it very well. You, introduced me to some more stuff that I'm definitely going to have to look into. Worth pointing out, how often emperors are coming from outside, not just Rome, but even Italy and the West at this point. In the coming crisis, we're even going to get one guy named Philip the Arabian or Philip the Arab, who may or may not be an Arab, but he's from that far east. We can talk to him and talk about him or his ilk during the crisis in due course.
Yeah, and I guess one other thing to point out that he did along with this sort of gender stuff that was too far even for otherwise generally very tolerant Romans.
Mm-hmm.
One of the sources, and I'm not sure if this is archaeological or if this is Historia Augusta or what, suggests that he made his mother and grandmother senators. is true, that is the only example of women having sort of actual political power in Roman institutions in the Western Empire.
Interesting.
So you get into Byzantium, then you have empresses, then you have, you know, women being more involved, but that it's the only time anything like that happens.
Interesting.
So he dies, gets replaced by Alexander Severus, or Severus Alexander. Alexander's the last of the Severans, maybe the best of them. We don't know, because his reign was just so busy fighting on the borders of the empire that he never really got involved in domestic politics. He does some economic stuff here and there. He does encourage, from what we can tell, sort of the arts and literature. So we have kind of a Bronze Age of Latin taking off at this point. So correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the Golden Age is under Augustus, the Silver Age is under the five good emperors, where we have sort of the last great pagan writers, and then the Bronze Age is beginning here. But
that sounds right to me.
So this is kind of the last time we have a cluster of great writers in one spot. I think I can say this and keep our rating. The feces hits the fan on the borders of the empire in Alexander's reign. That's a good Latinism there. The Parthian Empire collapses and becomes the Persian Empire again. So maybe Caracalla was just ahead of his time. And starts this massive war with Rome that Alexander only barely manages to win. Just as this war wraps up, hordes of Germans start to pour across the Danube River into the empire. He marches north. The legions are still fairly battered from the war with Parthia. And remember, discipline had gotten lax in the Roman army. So he starts to reinstill discipline in the troops and try to get back to the classic Roman army. To buy time while he does this, he bribes the Germans to go home. The army is absolutely not okay. Yeah. Well, and the army is not okay with that. You know, I didn't join the army to pay Germans not to fight, and I didn't join the army to have to run laps and do push-ups or whatever the Roman equivalent was. So the army assassinates Alexander and brings an end to the Severan dynasty.
Because all other things being equal, combat means that if you win, you get plunder in addition to your pay. So there's, right. there's, you know, reading military memoirs and military history, you know, particularly in the modern era, there's kind of an ambivalent attitude toward actually going to combat. The ancient world attitudes are considerably different, and that has a lot to do with what they get out of it. Right. There's a certain materialistically motivated eagerness to it, in addition to the kind of generally honorable place of war in their culture anyway. The desire for plunder is going to be a big issue, especially as pay starts to fail.
Right, and you again, you really see that desire for plunder coupled with the lack of desire for the sort of work that it takes to be a good soldier.
Right.
That just over and over and over comes back to haunt the Romans. And how do you maintain discipline in your army while also having an army that wants to go fight battles? Well, it wants to win battles. It doesn't necessarily want to fight them, but it wants the results of it.
Right. But one other thing, there are at least a few people that I've read who think possibly Severus Alexander is a bit of a figurehead, and that it's actually his mother and grandmother really calling the shots. This makes me, not to be too flippant, it kind of made me think of him as the Norman Bates of Roman emperors, where, you know, a boy's best friend is his mother. He's actually in a pretty pitiful scene. He's actually, according to the stories, murdered while cowering in his mother's arms.
Right. Right. And again, that's entirely possible. Obviously, his mother and grandmother are both very formidable figures.
Right.
And pulling a lot of strings in Rome, which itself may have been something the army didn't appreciate, even if the results are maybe politically good. Again, the army is now picking the emperor. They elevate a soldier who's known to be a great fighter, who is physically huge and scary looking, and who was a peasant by birth, named Maximus the Thracian. Once you've got someone being picked, not because of experience or ability, but because of his physical size, you can see why this is considered the beginning of the crisis of the third century. Anything to add on the Severans?
I think we've got it pretty well covered.
So Severus Alexander is assassinated in 235 AD. This brings about the greatest crisis of the Roman Empire so far, and it almost collapses. The fact that it survives the third century crisis is truly impressive. Even people at the time seem not to have thought they were going to make it. Something preserves Rome for various reasons. We can go ahead and say Providence. This is a Christian podcast. But it is very much by the skin of their teeth. From 235 to 284, a little under a 50-year period, at least 33 emperors rule, sometimes four or five at once. Sometimes more, and as Jordan pointed out, we discover that there are more emperors that pop up from time to time. As far as we can tell, all of these emperors did not die of natural causes. I guess one of them died of plague, so we can count that as a natural cause. But of the ones that we know of, 17 of them were killed by another emperor. Four were killed by their own army. Four were killed by the Praetorian Guard. Three were assassinated. Three were killed in combat with non-Romans. One died of plague. One just nobody knows what happened to him. Again, none of these guys die of natural causes. Most of them were chosen either by the Senate or the Praetorian Guard. At least two of them were forced to become emperor. This is no longer the great desirable job. One of them, of these two that were forced to become emperor, one was then assassinated by the Praetorian Guard who had forced him to become emperor. The other was assassinated by a rival emperor who had been appointed by the Senate. So the people who appointed him then appointed someone else who had him killed. Many of these guys were from outside of Italy, mostly from neighboring provinces, from Gaul or kind of the Mediterranean coast, not the Mediterranean coast, the Adriatic coast, Illyricum and so on. Some were from as far away as Carthage or Syria, Palmyra in the east. While this chaos is going on within the empire, while all of these people are fighting over the big seat, the border defenses get neglected. So as the civil wars go on, as there's conflict in the empire, the army begins to be stripped away from the border in support of various claimants to the throne. Germans begin to raid into Roman territory. Some of them are allowed to stay, but you don't really have massive invasions. You don't have a huge influx of German peoples. That actually doesn't come until after Rome is stabilized and is able to face the Nazis again. It's a very fortunate turn of events here. What you have going on instead is regional rebellions, where a local ruler, a local aristocrat of some kind will set up his own state, his own territory, and declare a pseudo independence from Rome. So the most famous example of this is the one that's led by a woman, Queen Zenobia, sets up a small empire around the city of Palmyra, which has been in the news recently. Apparently, yeah. ISIS destroyed her palace. So it's one of the best ruins in the Middle East. One of the most well-preserved is this palace of Queen Zenobia, and ISIS blew it up.
Along with a temple to Baal, who may or may not be the same Baal in the name Iligabal.
Right. So yeah, again, there's this stuff is still in the news. You have similar things going on in France. North Africa, various other places around the empire. And again, because they're so busy, fighting amongst themselves, because everything is in chaos, these independent kingdoms or pseudo independent kings, they would still say they're Roman. They do manage to survive for quite a while. Again, we see the money continues to decline. It declines much faster now. Again, this is where we start seeing, coins that are sort of a base metal with a silver wash over the top of them. Basically what our money is, although our money doesn't really even pretend to be silver or gold. They begin to look, zinc. they begin to be more and more like that. And again, we start seeing things like wooden coins pop up here and there. Anything to add on in this chaos? Again, the sources aren't great here, but from what we can tell, things were really bad sort of all over the place.
Yeah, that's the best way to sum it up. Again, I have a really great book I'll go ahead and recommend called The Handbook to Life in Ancient Rome. I think it's from Oxford, UP. It's about 20 years old now, so probably what I'm about to say could have been supplemented since then. But again, just doing a count between Commodus and Diocletian, who we'll wrap up on here in a minute. Just doing a count between those emperors gives a even higher number than we've given. And for some of these guys, you basically have little more than what Wikipedia would call a stub article, right? It's like, you know, date of death, circa this time, no date of birth, probably a general from this particular province, acclaimed by his legion, probably killed such and such a time. I mean, this is how vaguely we understand what's going on. Really all we have a sense of is kind of the larger trends, the really big currents, and even those are confused. The big thing to note, and again, this is something that would have sort of been on the back burner for the people that we're talking about. They're consumed with the control of the empire, with who is going to be the emperor, with the armies that are marching around. The border is going to assume massive significance in the coming century. And especially as you pointed out, with the hiring of what are called foederati or federati. Essentially, this is not a great comparison, but the way I illustrate this to my 101 students is, imagine hiring the cartels for border defense in Texas.
Sort of a Roman version of Fast and Furious, right?
Yeah, something like that. Again, it's not a one-to-one comparison. We can of course make it more nuanced, but essentially, in some places, a ambitious emperor or maybe an ambitious legion who acclaims their general emperor, in order to defend that claim, they've got to leave. So who's going to watch the border? Either hire locals or pay some of these Germans on the other side of the Rhine or the Danube in particular to come across, basically sponsor them to outsource the defense of the frontier. This is a negative trend that really picks up pace during this time, and it's going to cause a lot of problems down the road.
Yeah, and really the only real high point in this time is one guy who does manage to sort of bring it all together, an emperor named Aurelian.
Mm-hmm.
So from 270 to 275, so, you know, we're 40 years into the crisis. He does manage to become sole emperor of all of it.
And a 5-year reign is astounding at this point.
It really is. And by all accounts, he was an able general. He was a decentish administrator. So he again, solidifies power in himself. He travels the width and the breadth of the empire, puts down all of the incursions on the borders, deals with these kingdoms that had declared independence. So he shuts down Zenobia's Palmyra. He shuts down the rebellions in Gaul, in France, and he shuts down some minor rebellions here and there. And he starts cleaning up the government. He starts sort of wiping out the administrators who, you know, when there's no emperor, the administrators can kind of do whatever they want. So in the last 40 years, they've become very, very corrupt. So he starts cleaning out these guys, and that actually ends up getting him killed. As he is kind of purging the ranks, he purges the secretary who's in charge of keeping the names that are to be purged from government. So the secretary gets a note that he is set to be fired, maybe fired, maybe executed. We don't know for sure. He changes his name on the note to the name of one of Aurelian's big generals, takes it to that general and says, "Hey, look, the emperor's about to kill you." So the general then goes and kills Aurelian. So the secretary sort of saved his own life. And then it comes out what the secretary had done, and he gets executed too. But again, you have this sort of backstabbing corruption, even at very high levels. Aurelian is interesting for religious reasons also. The story is that he was an extreme polytheist. So he would basically worship any god that you could ever care to mention. So he traveled with him in his quarters, in his personal quarters. He would have statues of as many gods as he possibly could, and he would try to pray to all of them, like in rotation. According to some of the sources, he would have, you know, a statue of Zeus, a statue of, you know, Apollo, a statue of Jesus, a statue of all of these different guys that he would then just go around, which means that he was not necessarily big into persecution. And that's kind of a transition into, this is a very bad time for Rome. It's a very good time for Christianity. We'll do a whole episode on that. But Jordan, anything you want to say briefly about that? Here?
I think that pretty well wraps it up. It's long, it's arduous, lots of people get killed, it's confusing. It's minus the fatalities, it's basically the Republican convention going on right now.
Right. Well, so far, right? We're not through the convention yet.
And again, because
there is such chaos at the top, it means that the cults in the empire can basically grow unchecked, including right. Christianity. So Christianity spreads sort of like wildfire while all of this is going on, for many reasons, but not least of which being that they have a stable administrative apparatus.
Right.
They have an institution that, even while everything else is falling apart, it's holding fairly solid. You know, that idea of the local people electing their own bishops and it doesn't matter who the emperor is. Well, that becomes kind of a point of solidity. And we'll get to that down the road. So this crisis comes to an end, beginning with an emperor named Carus. He ruled sort of 282 to 283, somewhere in there. Seems to have been a decent emperor. The empire seems to be on the rebound. Again, our sources are not great here. We do know that Carus had enough power and control and ability that he managed to mount an invasion of Persia that succeeded in burning the Persian capital. So something must have been restored if he's able to get the troops together to do that and actually carry it off. When he dies on the campaign, his sons return to the Roman Empire. They divide it up between themselves, with one of them taking the west and one of them taking the east. The one who takes the east dies of mysterious causes, and the soldiers declare his cavalry commander to be his replacement. This is Diocletian. The emperor in the west is not okay with that. He marches eastward, fights Diocletian's army at the Battle of the Margus River in 285, where we don't know what happened. We don't even know who won that battle. We do know that that the Western emperor dies after the battle. So Diocletian is now the sole emperor of Rome. And from that point on, we have lots of decline. We do have more civil wars coming up, but never again that huge stretch of just utter chaos. Nothing even close to that. Anything to add about anything we've covered today so far, Jordan?
I don't think so. Diocletian's a good place to leave off. We will see under him a pretty radical transformation. The office of the emperor, which is sort of unofficially introduced by Augustus as kind of a, you know, official, not official, right? He's just the princeps, some, you know, made official and permanent, and actually, you know, with certain delimited characteristics by Vespasian, and has gotten increasingly crazier, is going to finally enter a, what a couple of older writers, this language probably wouldn't fly now, describe as, you know, in very un-Roman terms, as basically becoming an Oriental potentate. By the time we get to Diocletian, we're going to see a complete transformation of, if not Roman politics, then Roman leadership. But, and you know, that seems like a pretty striking place to pick up.
Right, right. And I mean, yeah, we'll talk about that. Diocletian loves the bling. I mean, he's a very good emperor, but he's always wearing these fancy robes and lots of jewelry. And I mean, yeah.
It begins to look a lot more Byzantine.
Right.
Even though that's,
on purpose.
Right.
He does that intentionally too. That is not uncalculated.
Yeah. He's as attentive to his PR as Augustus is, but with radically different results.
Right. Right. And well, yeah, well, let's save that for you. I'm saying,
I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself.
But because it works. I mean, it does last for a very long time.
Right.
But,
1,000 years in the East.
Right. So I mean, there is something to it. But again, Augustus would have been horrified.
Right.
Augustus would not have been okay with that at all. What we should ask again, what we asked last time to fill out our bracket of the emperors we talked about today. Best emperor, worst emperor, craziest emperor. Who do we have? How do you fill out that bracket, Jordan?
The hard choice this time around is going to be best, because it seems like saying, okay, pick one of these dozen rotten eggs to eat. You know, which one is the least rotten?
Sure.
Well, I'll go ahead and mark Caracalla as the worst.
Okay.
Elagabalus seems like a shoe-in for craziest, even before I found out. Yeah, even before I found out some of the new stuff I'd never heard before today. For best, I guess I'd have to go with maybe Septimius Severus or Severus Alexander, but that seems like damning with faint praise.
Yeah, I'll agree with you about the craziest. Worst, I think I could see Caracalla. I would maybe lean towards Didius Julianus.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, buying the emperor, empire.
No, I'd agree.
But yeah, I would be down with Caracalla too. So, and certainly he ruled longer.
Right.
That, you know, citizenship to all freemen in the empire, just such a bad idea. And I know that's not a very democratic thing for me to say, but, and best, I'm actually going to go with Aurelian.
Yeah, that works.
So if we take them overall, so best emperor from the first 300 years of Roman history. So last episode and this episode, putting our brackets together.
Okay. So I know the final four. What's the two? Just the final game, I guess. I don't know.
No, I don't remember who we said last time.
Yeah, I'm not a college sports guy. I'm revealing a lot about myself today. For best, I'm probably just going to go all the way back to the beginning and say Augustus.
Okay.
I think, you know, without him, nothing else. What he set up, although modified sometimes drastically and retooled repeatedly, the institution he created continued in some form through the entire period that we've talked about. And again, it's amazing that it outlasted some of the crises that it went through, and I think you can trace at least some of that stamina back to him. He also, I think, probably used his power for the best and least bad purposes of any of the people that we've talked about. Man, worst. It's pretty sad when there's this much competition for this place.
Sure.
Worst, I'll still go all the way back to Nero. And craziest, shoot. I'm a Julio-Claudian guy, so I'll go with Caligula there too.
All right, so you're going old school. I was thinking about this over the last week, and I actually think I'm going to agree with you on Augustus. Because like you said, it lasts so long. I mean, you have people, you know, into the Middle Ages, into the Renaissance, into the modern world, you have people saying, I'm the Roman emperor.
Right.
So, I mean, that what the Habsburgs finally collapsed in, what, 1918. So
yeah.
You have an emperor that claims to be a sort of political descendant of Augustus up until the 20th century. So yeah, I think you've sold me on that.
Yeah.
Craziest, I'm going to go with the guy who married the son. That's, you know, I think that's tough to beat.
I'm cool with that.
And then worst emperor. Yeah. Like you said, that's a larger pool to draw from. I think you might have even sold me on Caracalla on that one. So I'll keep it later. I'll go with Caracalla. And maybe if I can figure out how to do it, maybe we'll throw this bracket up in the show notes, and the one or two people who listen can fill this out.
Hey, they are our kind of people.
Yeah, there you go.
both of you, thank you for listening.
Presumably our wives, have to. I do torture my wife with this. We listen to a draft of it before it goes live, so cool. So she will have listened to much of this.
Hey, the support helps.
Yeah, it does. Well, in that way, I know we have at least one listener.
Yeah.
How does this matter for today? So the stuff we talked about today is getting kind of increasingly arcane, increasingly unique to Rome, right? I mean, we're pretty unlikely to elect a president. I say that realizing that it's a weird election year. We are unlikely to elect a president that thinks he's a woman.
Yeah.
Or that thinks he's married to the son or anything like that. How does this stuff matter for today?
Yeah, that is difficult. The further we've gotten from Augustus, the less easy it is to map the Roman situation onto our own situation, where, again, with the founding fathers, it seemed like a piece of cake, right? They wanted to create the kind of republic that, you know, and they even adopted names like Brutus and Cato to, you know, as pseudonyms for their pamphlet wars. Now that we are well into the empire, and though debatably having one, the United States has always shied away from declaring itself any kind of empire. The word empire kind of has a sour taste in the American mouth, especially in the last 100 years, since, sure, you know, Roosevelt and, through the Spanish-American War, and then, sort of some of Roosevelt's dealings kind of built one. And that was sort of the last time that was cool. I was a lot more sanguine about making comparisons in college. I actually wrote a series of letters to the editor of my hometown newspaper as like a college junior, which I'm sure would be embarrassing, comparing the situation on the Roman borders with the situation on American borders. And that's a comparison I wouldn't make anymore.
I was secretly hoping you were going to go full Donald Trump here and talk about, we need control of the borders.
These Germans
built a lot of walls.
Well, it's these Germans and these Picts. They come across our borders and they rape our women and they, you know, deal whatever the third century equivalent of drugs is. I don't know. I think I would have to think a little bit more about it to find real parallels. But the dangers are in extending, maybe to find a couple of general principles, extending privileges too freely, placing too much trust in military power, in whichever direction we're talking about, and becoming so completely self-absorbed that internal dissension becomes the crisis rather than just looking out for a continued peaceful traditional existence like had been established by Augustus. Does that make any kind of sense to you?
Yeah, no, and I think I'd agree, although I would, I'm a little happier to make some parallels, in part because I think both they and we struggle to appropriately pay attention to the military. So there's sort of an overemphasis in the, and I watched again, this is dating us a little bit, the first night of the Republican convention was, among other things, a long stream of the American military could never ever possibly lose if only we would just, unleash them, if only we would stop tying their hands politically, and a very Vietnam era rhetoric going on at the Republican convention. The Romans clearly have sort of that same attitude. The Roman legions could never lose, right? The Roman legions could never possibly not win any war if only we would fight it the right way with the right guy at the head. if only we had the right person at the helm. But at the same time, I think both the modern Americans and Romans in this time period, at least the Romans in the military, I don't know anything about the guy on the street, but the Romans in the military show an unwillingness to be the sort of people that can win. To live the sort of lives that are necessary to have the discipline and the training and do the hard work, put in the hours on the treadmill or running formations or again, whatever it is that you have to do to get in shape, to work as a unit, to coordinate with other units and so on. And of course you have the problem of the people at the top, sort of an inverse problem to what we've got today. In Rome, the people at the top were always generals, which meant politically they didn't necessarily know what they were doing, which caused all sorts of problems. Today we have kind of the other option. We have, basically no generals, no people who really know military at the top, who are still making military decisions.
Right. And if you hang out and if you hang out in any great amount with members of the military, I've got a lot of friends in the Army and the Marine Corps. That is a very common complaint that the people higher up have no clue.
Well, and it's not, and I think the response needs to be more subtle than I'm making it here. But if you look at the number of congressmen and high level executive branch bureaucrats who have served in the military, that has taken a steep dive in the past few years. So we not only don't have presidents who have combat experience or have leadership in combat experience. We now no longer have kind of the top tier of government who has that. Right. There are a handful still. It's not none, but it's certainly fewer than it was 50 years ago. Now I think there needs to be more nuance to a longer discussion where all military decisions are to some extent political decisions and all political decisions are going to have military consequences. So it's a false dichotomy, but well, yeah, it is. The military will say something like, just let us do our job. But the military's job is not to decide what its job is. Like that is a political decision. But then politicians will say, well, we'll do the political stuff and you do the military stuff and then come up with all of these rules that are, totally military, engagement rules and what you have to say to civilians and so on. I mean, it ends up being they're trying to separate themselves out without realizing that they're not actually separate.
Right.
So if you don't realize that, you can't do your job on either side very well.
And go ahead.
No, just again, the Romans had exactly the same thing. It was just the other way around.
Right.
It was you have the military doing everything without the professional bureaucrats, without the skilled administrators on the political side.
Yeah, this thought just occurred to me as well, thinking about my friends and family in the military and the numbers of people involved in high-level decisions who have actually served. For lack of a better word, kind of the imperial activities of the United States in the last several years have sort of, especially as the reliance on the military has continued to be very strong, have started to kind of open up what were already there, pre-existing fissures in American culture, American society. You can sort of see this at work in the Roman Empire as well, where the culture of the military is developing in different and very distinct directions from the culture of the man on the street, right? So I don't want to use the word caste because that makes medieval life sound a lot more kind of hidebound than it actually is. But the sort of distinctions between, famously those who fight, those who farm, and those who pray are already sort of there in embryonic form. And by the same token, in the United States, especially because a disproportionate number of military personnel come from the South, Southerners have, beyond their actual proportion of the population, always supplied a higher percentage of military personnel. There's not just a sense that politicians don't know how the military works. There's also a deep sense that, politicians from somewhere else. While the military does bring people together from all over the United States and even from outlying territories, the culture of the South continues to be considerably more military friendly, and military personnel know that. You can go all the way back. I think I've mentioned David Hackett Fisher on here before, but his Albion Seed thesis, the different mm-hmm. even just the people who came from England in the early colonial days came from different cultures. And there's a number of books out there on similar theses that the United States is not really a nation. Instead, it is a kind of group of independent nations. When you define it linguistically by things like dialect, culturally, the cultural distinctions are very severe, and they break down along political and military lines in a very potentially significant way, I think.
Yeah, and that's so you talked about the fissures in society. I think that another point of sort of comparison is the collapsing of the citizen versus non-citizen distinction.
Yeah.
Right. So again, we have the Edict of Caracalla, where just now everyone is a citizen. We have not yet done that in the United States, but there is also a decline in the idea that there's a substantive legal difference between someone who is an American citizen and someone who is not an American citizen, whether they're here legally or not.
Right.
Right. I have to be careful. I'm not wandering too close to Donald Trump. Which is not to say that, I think non-citizens are somehow inherently immoral. So I guess there I'll distance myself.
Yeah.
It is to say that in the past, there were very clear legal lines. So differences in terms of rights, differences in terms of access to certain privileges, differences in terms of, you know, basically name your topic. And there was some kind of difference that over the past 60, 70 years has declined to the point of really there's no difference anymore. I mean, there's really nothing that a non-citizen, whether here legally or not, can't do that I can do as a citizen. There's not a difference anymore. That does affect your state. Whether it affects it negatively or positively, we could have that argument, but we can't say it doesn't have any effect. Certainly it had an impact on Rome. It meant that it was harder to sort of sort out when there was a crisis, how do you solve it? Because you don't even know who to ask to solve it.
Right. Well, and you know, the old expression, the law is a teacher. I mean, when the law says that you get everything by virtue of existing, the incentive to participate and be invested in your society evaporates. And we're seeing some of that.
Right. Right. Well, that's probably enough of grousing about kids these days.
us young fogies.
Yeah, I assume our reading recommendations are pretty much the same from last time. Did you have anything to add?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, just listen to the reading recommendations from last time again. We'll have some new stuff probably next time.
Right, and again, this is where Gibbon gets good. So if you haven't read Gibbon, this is the place to find. And with that, The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out our other podcasts in the family and get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please do leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song and Jordan Poss, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's.